Riley Crane is next. He is a Society and Science Senior Postdoctoral Fellow in the Human Dynamics Group at MIT's Media Lab. He's a physicist by training, but his research is focused on uncovering the hidden patterns behind collective social behavior. His projects seek to understand very generally how information spreads, and he has modeled systems including YouTube and the humanitarian response to the Asian tsunami. Riley is the winner of the 2009 Pentagon-sponsored DARPA Network Challenge, a competition that explored how the internet and social networks can be used to solve broad-scope, time-critical problems. In addition, he consults for business and government and has started several companies which harness the power of social networks and social media. Riley is here to speak about the challenge of fostering efficient communication among a crowd of strangers. Please welcome Riley Crane.
Thanks, Nathan. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm incredibly excited to be here to talk to you today about the science of engagement and rethinking communication to solve really hard problems. Yesterday, just before lunch, we saw a talk about how to harness swarms of robots to solve really hard problems. And so in many ways, this talk, just before lunch again, is going to be thinking about how we can program swarms of humans to solve really hard problems. And so the first thing that I want to ask all of you to do is to pull out your phones, turn them on, get them ready to send a couple of text messages, because I'm going to ask you to help me solve a couple of hard problems during the talk. So if you'd get that set up and ready to send something, it'll come up in just a minute. So the world's becoming more responsive, and it's becoming more social and more connected. And these connections create enormous opportunities for us to engage with people in new ways and to organize people in new ways and to empower them to solve really hard problems. Now, in this new world, everyone wants to know, how can we begin to tap into these new connections and solve the problems that we care about, right? Authors want to sell more books. The law enforcement agencies want to use these new connections to track down criminals. The disenfranchised want to start revolutions. We know that in order to tap into and to succeed in this new world, we need to tap into these new connections and engage with people in new ways. And so while enormous amounts of money and talent and energy have been poured into understanding this problem, there are still very few best practices. Right? We've all heard anecdotes of people, and I'm going to tell you some stories as well, that show this great success of tapping into networks and engaging people and motivating people in new ways. But in spite of all of that, there's still little prescriptive advice that I could offer any of you to solve the problem that you care about solving. Now, I want to tell you today a couple of stories that I think will illustrate some guiding principles, some of the things that can get us closer to understanding, for whatever problem we care about, what it is you need to do or what you need to start to think about to take advantage of some of these new connections. And so it's really going to focus on first understanding how individuals behave, then understanding how groups of individuals behave, and then asking, well, how can we shape the behavior of those groups to get them to do big things? And so I actually want to start by telling you how I got interested in these types of problems. What you see here is the lab where I did my dissertation, and back then I was a physicist studying electrons. And I know that the moment you say physics and electrons, most people's eyes glaze over and your brains shut down and you go into comatose mode. But what's interesting about these types of problems is that here you have large groups of interacting individuals, in this case the electrons, exhibiting all sorts of really complex behaviors. And I could tune the interactions between these electrons and get them to behave in different ways. And so if I would change the magnetic field and the temperature in just the right way, suddenly these groups of electrons would behave like a clone army, falling into lockstep, behaving and responding to every command I could give them. But if I tune their interactions a little bit differently by raising the temperature, for example, then suddenly they would devolve into this disorganized, chaotic mess. And what happens is there's this really interesting point just between this highly organized, highly structured behavior and this disorganized chaos where something really interesting happens. And what happens is it's as if the properties of the electrons at that point are like a powder keg, waiting for any small spark, any small perturbation to just radically change. And so at the end of my dissertation, I started thinking about whether or not social systems behaved with any sort of similar regularity or similar rules, when we see things like big protests, or we see things like blockbuster books and movies come out, is it that there's some kind of regularity and organizing principle behind them that's the same, or at least can map in some ways to these kinds of problems that we are studying in physics? And so this is a really important question, because I started by saying I want to talk about how we can shape behavior in social systems to solve really hard problems. But there's a more fundamental question we have to ask, which is, do social systems follow any behavior and regularities? Because if they don't, then all bets are off. I can give you whatever strategy that I decide to sell to you that week, and you're going to try it, and sometimes it'll work, and I'll say, God, I'm such a clever guy. Look at the success I can generate. But then sometimes it'll fail, and I'll say, well, you know, that's life. These things are messy. And so if we want to be able to try to accomplish big things over and over, we need to answer that question of, do these systems behave regularly? And so the kinds of problems I got interested in studying then were things like this. If you don't know, this is a Susan Boyle. She's an unattractive, previously unknown singer from Scotland who shot to overnight worldwide success a couple years ago after delivering this great opera performance on Britain's Got Talent. What you see here is the global activity measured by the number of tweets mentioning her name. And in these types of patterns, what you find are these large spikes driven by the media when they broadcast these events and people pick up on it. But mixed in with that are these sort of smaller sort of word of mouth effects that occur as people tell their friends and their friends tell their other friends. So I spent a long time studying these types of systems, and we found over and over again these incredible regularities in all sorts of different types of systems describing human behavior and collective human behavior. So most of the work that I focused on was studying views on YouTube, but we found this over again in books, in web visitation patterns, in response to the Asian tsunami measured by donations, even in the number of sales of the albums of a famous singer after his death. And over again, we saw this pattern that told us that maybe there is some underlying organization that can help us understand how these systems are organizing themselves. So the key to understanding this riddle is to answer the next question. So how long do you guys expect to wait to see the next slide? So I want you to pull out your phones. We're going to do our first. I want you to vote. I'm going to put up a phone number on the screen. And I want you to send a text message to that number with the number of seconds you think you're going to have to wait to see the next slide. Give me just a second to get it loaded here. Let it refresh. Give me one more second. I'm on a slow Wi-Fi network. And I hope it's going to refresh. Or not. Okay, there it goes. Okay. And let me shut that down. Okay, so go ahead and pull out your phones and start voting. Okay, I guess some of you have. Now what we're seeing here is all of you have some information about how long I'm talking and how long you expect to wait to see the next slide. This is a sort of classic example of the wisdom of the crowds. Each of you votes, and we're going to aggregate your votes to come up with the best possible estimate of how long you expect to wait. Now we're coming along. I'm about 8 minutes into this, and this is probably my eighth slide, so it's roughly about a minute, and you guys are getting pretty close. Not many of you are voting. I need you to get out your phones. But so what's interesting about this is that none of you said 10 minutes. None of you said a day, right? I guess lunch is coming up, so you're hoping it's not a day. None of you said a week or a month or a year to get to the next slide. Why? The reason you didn't is that implicit in what's happening here is that my slides, oh wow, awesome. Well, I'm glad that game's over. Let's get the next one loaded up for the. So implicit in what's going on here is that my slides are governed by a Poisson process, a random process. And a random process doesn't mean it's random and you don't know when it's going to happen. A random process in mathematics means that it's defined, it has a well-defined average. So maybe one slide is 30 seconds, one slide is 45 seconds, but on average it's around 35 seconds. And so let me jump back into the slides. Now, what if I asked you a slightly different question? How long would you expect to wait to receive a response if you sent Einstein or Darwin a letter? Right. probably today you'd wait a long time because both these men are dead. But these two men were incredibly famous, incredibly important figures, and so people have looked at this. And because of their fame and historical importance, people have looked at the number of letters they sent and received over their entire lives, and these letters have timestamps on them. So you can actually count, when somebody sent Einstein or Darwin a letter, how long did they have to wait to get a response? And what you see plotted down here in a log-log plot is the probability of waiting a certain amount of time in days when you sent one of these men a letter. And so while in the top you see the number of letters they sent and received over their entire lifetimes, and you see that this is kind of chaotic and so on, if you take that and you average it over their entire lives, you see this very clean, regular pattern. And what it says, this is nothing more than a statistical fingerprint that describes procrastination. Right? It says that most of the time when you sent one of these men a letter, the response time would be about a day. That's the most likely outcome. But what about 10 days? Well, it was a little bit less likely. And 100 days, it was less likely, but it still happened. And so you can actually look at this, and what this really says is that the longer you wait to do something, the longer you're going to wait to do it. We all know this with emails, with everything we do, right? If you don't do it immediately, you're not going to do it. So this has been studied not only in these two men, but in thousands upon thousands of people in all sorts of activities, ranging from web viewing patterns to checking out library books and all sorts of other things, and the pattern is stable. People behave like this. So what this says is that if people have this sort of innate way that they respond to probes, then maybe we can use that to understand something about how groups of people behave. And so that's what we did a long time ago. Turned out it works quite well. But the takeaway from this is that if you want to get large groups of people to do things, you're fighting the economics of attention. Right? In an information-rich environment, what's scarce is attention. Scarce, it's attention is then valuable because it's so scarce. And so if you want to get people to participate and be involved, you have to make it incredibly easy for them to act immediately. Now, I want to ask you a slightly different problem. We're all looking at this, and I want to ask all of you, how would you get, if you had to go across this field, how would you get to this mountain in the background? Most of you would probably take this path, right? This path is another great example of a wisdom of the crowds type phenomenon, that this is an incredibly rich landscape that thousands upon thousands of people had solved the problem of how to get across it, and what emerged was this path that showed you the way. So this is a kind of a great example of crowdsourcing a solution to a hard problem. We see this in everyday experience nowadays with things like Google Instant, right? As you start typing, you're navigating this incredibly complex, rich information landscape, and Google, through aggregating the billions upon billions upon billions of people that have come here before you, can now paint a statistical picture of where you're trying to go through this rich information landscape. So again, this is a hard problem that was solved by aggregating all of the effects of individual behavior, each person taking some kind of an input, and you put them together, and it solves this problem. We see all sorts of hard problems being solved today by systems that aggregate the input of the crowd. For example, I can now get great restaurant recommendations, or I can get great movie recommendations or music recommendations. And this is all happening because it's aggregating the behavior of people and then painting a path through this landscape. But there are all sorts of hard problems that you can't solve by aggregating. And to give you an example, I want you to pull out your phones again. We're going to do the second game. So it's the same phone number, so it should be a bit easier. This time I want you to send in a direction, N, S, E, or W. And sending that in will move the ball along one of these directions. And now, this is a different kind of coordination problem. The goal here is to move the ball to one of these purple squares. Now, I ask if you could. We need a few more south votes here, because we've lost the ball. This is a problem that no person in here could individually solve. You can't move the ball diagonally. And there we go. Now we're overcompensating. Oh, very close. So, but what you see is that solving even this very simple problem is incredibly complicated, right? Each of you is voting, and there it goes again. I'm gonna jump back to the talk. See, so What's interesting, though, is that we have all of these connections. We have all of these ways of communicating. And this really started 40 years ago when DARPA invented the internet. And this was followed 20 years later by the World Wide Web that started connecting together all of the world's publicly available information. And now we have this sort of new world where, with all of our devices and all of our, you know, social networks and so on, for the first time we're starting to connect together people and places and things. And so DARPA was really interested in saying, well, now with this new layer, can we use it to solve really hard problems? Problems that require coordination, problems that require people like you collaborating and working together to solve a problem that none of you could solve by yourselves. So about 2 years ago, they posed this challenge. They said, we're going to give $40,000 to the first person who can find 10 balloons hidden somewhere in the United States. They're going to be visible for a single day, tied to the ground, for anywhere between 6 and 9 hours before they'll be pulled down. And it was to explore these types of things and whether you can solve these kinds of problems. So I heard about this challenge 4 days before it started from a friend of mine who sent me an email and said, I guess the Media Lab is signing up. I sent this out to our group and asked if anyone had a $40,000 idea, and one of the postdocs in our group immediately responded in classic nerd style by quoting one of the most famous papers on search in global social networks and saying that although global search in global social networks is possible, the actual success will depend sensitively on individual incentives. And so we knew that we had to solve a very hard incentive problem. And so we said, okay, there's 10 balloons, $40,000, we're going to assign a value of $4,000 to each balloon. If you come along and you find one, we'll give you $2,000, and we'll give the other $2,000 to charity. That's great. I can tell all of you, and now I've got a room full of people who can go out and start looking around the world for me. Right? But it's limited in scope. It's limited in how many people can I tell. So we realized we needed to make it in your interest to tell other people. So we said, well, you don't have to find a balloon. If you tell others and they find the balloon, we're going to give them the $2,000 because they did the hard work. We're going to give you half of the remaining, and we'll give the other half to charity. And then this continues on and on and on until you end up splitting pennies. So, built a system that essentially you'd come to our site, which was balloon.mit.edu, you'd enter your email and a username, and this would generate a personal URL. This was your solution. This was what you had to go out into the world and tell everyone about. And we didn't care how you went out and broadcast this. You could have put it on a sign, you could have sent an email, posted on Facebook, whatever. If your friends clicked on it, they would come back and see exactly the same site that you saw when you signed up, except that they're at your personal URL, and when they sign up, they get their own personal link, and then they could go out and share it, and so on. But behind the scenes, we could keep track of how this was going and how this was spreading. And so about a day before the challenge began, we got picked up in Slashdot, and I'm showing here the number of participants on our team just before this event and how it skyrocketed up. And I always love, this is one of my favorite quotes on that post, that people think it could have gone a little bit faster if there had been a little boy trapped inside of each balloon. So what I want to do for just a minute is I've compressed the entire day's worth of signups into a sound file that lasts about a minute. And what it does is it encodes in sound this global spreading process as people signed up, and then they told their friends, and their friends signed up, and so on. And I just want to give you a taste of what it's like to experience this kind of global collective problem solving. And so the way that I've encoded it is that anyone who signed up with the MIT team directly, they get a very low frequency tone. If anyone who signed up as a result of a friend gets a slightly higher tone. And as you go down the chain of a friend of a friend of a friend, it gets higher and higher and higher. And so let me go ahead and train you a little bit, and let me get the, do we have sound up here? Let's try it again. There we go. So the low tones are the people who signed up originally, the higher tones, the higher tones, the higher tones are friends of friends of friends. So I'm going to jump to the part in the video, in the audio file where we just got this Slashdot effect, and it's compressing the entire sound of this into 1 minute. And what you see here on the screen is the actual network that we built. composed of thousands of people where the black dots are the nodes, the people, and the red lines are the connections between them. So if you listen to the low tones, they're occurring here. Higher tones are the farther and farther out. Sounds like a Vegas slot machine. And so that's actually a funny metaphor, because this started happening and we were all just blown away, and we thought, this is great. This is the day before the challenge. We've got this incredible team that we've built all around the country. And this is going to be no problem. We're going to come in tomorrow, start working on the challenge, and we'll be done before dinner. So we came into the office the next day, and this is what we saw. Right, people were seeing balloons in Canada. People were, you know, it seemed like car dealerships had taken off that day or something. And so we were really blown away by, and this is a bit of an overstatement, I wish we had had a map at that point. We really came in and were dealing with like raw data logs, and finally throughout the day we built these tools so we could visualize. But it turned out that not everybody wanted us to find the balloons. And so there was even, I've obscured the face here, but there was even a girl within the media lab who went so far as to get a team. They dressed up as DARPA employees, went around Cambridge flying a balloon, and then even went so far as to hack the EXIF coordinates on photos on an iPhone picture to change the GPS coordinates and upload it to Flickr. And so there was enormous amounts of sabotage going on. And so there were all sorts of stuff that we did to try to solve this. In the end, the most effective thing was that if you think about, you know, somebody reported seeing a balloon in Florida, but their computer's IP address says that they're in California, they probably didn't see it firsthand. And so we decided, well, let's see what happens if we ignore those. And you go from a picture like this to this. And so it cleans up pretty clearly when you only try to take into account firsthand effects. But even this is actually four balloons off. The final picture looked like this, that we found through a number of other mechanisms that I'd be happy to talk about later. But the thing that was sort of most surprising is that we did this, our team won the challenge in 8 hours and 52 minutes, and we, when looking at this, we were blown away by the fact that we now have systems in place that can solve challenges that are previously unimaginable. I mean, if you think about doing something like this, it's a toy problem, right? But it's still starting to show some of the possibilities of what we're going to be able to do going forward. And so this is all very exciting and so on. And the sort of takeaway from this is that if you want people to engage and help you solve your problem, right, the first thing is make it super easy so that they can, you know, you're fighting their attention. But if it's not easy enough, then you have to incentivize them, and that'll drive a lot of participation as well. But there are certain kinds of problems that are harder than that, that you can't just say, oh, let's come up with a clever incentive scheme and we'll solve the problem. And so I want to tell you one last story about something that I think illustrates, in my mind, the third principle in thinking about how to get large groups of people to solve problems. And this is a story that happened about a month after the balloon challenge, when there was an earthquake in Haiti. And there was an organization called Ushahidi that sort of became they had the best situational awareness of what was going on the ground, because they were crowdsourcing information and trying to make sense of what was going on. And so there was one incredible story where there was an urgent request asking for the coordinates of seven locations where people were known to be trapped. And so what this means is that in Haiti, you may say, well, there's someone trapped at the Holiday Inn, or there's someone trapped at 123 Main Street. But that doesn't map to any GPS coordinate. That doesn't mean you know how to get them. If you live there and you understand the lay of the land, you can, sure, get there. But in these undeveloped countries, they don't necessarily have these addresses mapped to geo-coordinates. And so this was the challenge. And there was a girl working with them on this at Ushahidi named Anna Schultz, and she was great at this. And she ended up finding six of the seven coordinates. And then she said she finished all but one at the Umbompri, so this is the place they were looking for. And it's near the Napolian Hotel, but she's having trouble finding it. Now, if you just think for a minute, you're a graduate student sitting in an apartment in snowy Cambridge, Massachusetts, looking for people trapped in a building in Haiti. And you think about, even 5 years ago, what would you have done? But there was nothing you could have done back then. And so what did she do today? She tweeted, right? She sent out this urgent request, and something remarkable happened. Somebody came back a couple hours later and said, look, I don't know where the Embonpre is, which is the place you're looking for, but I know that the Napoli Inn is actually part of the Holiday Inn chain. And so maybe that's helpful. So she went, and she was a very clever girl, and they were getting actually direct satellite feeds from the military at that point because they were kind of helping lead this effort. And they pulled up a map, and she said, you know what, it's a Holiday Inn, I bet they have a pool. And so she found the pool. So now she's closer to finding this coordinate. But she knows that the Embonpre is somewhere near this hotel, but doesn't quite know yet. And so something else remarkable happened. A few hours later, somebody tweeted at her and said, this guy used to work at that hotel. He lives in Brooklyn, call him. And so my friend Patrick, who was behind part of the effort at Ushahidi, he actually called this guy in the middle of the night, and the guy, in a mixed sort of broken French and English, they managed to, from that pool, walk down the street on the map to where that location was. And so I think, to me, what this says is that the last kind of point I want to make is that I think this illustrates our communication paradigms are broken, or they're at least in their adolescence. You know, if you think back to trying to solve these kinds of hard problems, I hope I've shown you some of the ways in which you can do it, but I think this really illustrates, even in this room trying to solve the silly problem of moving a ball to a purple square, these things are hard, and part of the reason they're hard is we don't have the tools to organize and coordinate in the times that we need to. And so we've known for a long time how society is organized. It's organized around strong ties and weak ties. Strong ties are your friends and your family. Weak ties are perhaps the people you've met at this conference or the people you used to drink with in college. And I would even argue that one of the reasons that Facebook has had so much success is that they solved a really hard communication problem with weak ties. Right? They made it that, you know, a few years ago, if you wanted to reach out to that friend from high school, or I actually just the other day reached out to a friend from where I grew up who I haven't talked to in years, but I came across this photo of him when he was 9 years old and thought, wow, this is incredible, and I wanted to share it with him. And if you think about how hard that would have been before something like Facebook, where I could just type in his name, type in where he grew up, and find him, and then share this with him, I think that's starting to tap into some of these new communication paradigms that we're thinking about. But I think there's this third class of ties that's really important for a lot of what I've been discussing, and that's these temporary or spontaneous ties. It's the people that you need to coordinate with, not because you're friends or not because you met each other or so on, but because you happen to be in the same location when a disaster occurs. You happen to be somewhere where you need to communicate not through friend linkages and phone numbers, but through context. Through the context of, I'm a person with medical training in this geolocation, and I'm open to being communicated with. And so I want to finish there by just saying that I think we have an opportunity to start to think about solving incredibly difficult challenges by harnessing, not necessarily machines, but harnessing the machines that live inside of each of you. And I think we're starting to see the beginnings of a system in which, if we start to look at these principles of getting people engaged by tapping into how people behave, in some sense exploiting everyone's procrastination for good, tapping into the fact that when that's too hard, we need to go to incentives, and then finally thinking about, when you have a problem to solve, what are the right tools and the right communication mechanisms that you need to get people organized, get them working together, and get out of their way? And so with that, I'd like to finish. I think there's a minute or two left for questions, and so thanks a lot.
We've got a couple minutes for questions before we go to lunch. Right here in the front row.
Thanks, fantastic talk, very inspiring. My name is Judy van Geest. I have a small question. What about your last slide? What about the role of reputation in solving those problems. What is your particular vision about that? Thanks.
So I think that's incredibly important. I think in many ways, in reflecting upon how we were able to solve the Red Balloon Challenge, it didn't escape our notice that we were MIT, right? And MIT fosters some sort of trust when you go out into these systems. And so I think reputations play an incredibly important role. And I think that there's a way of actually thinking about that as another form of an incentive, that often people are driven not by money. And in fact, after this project, I worked on a project with the United Nations to try to raise awareness about hunger. And there was nothing at all. We weren't paying people to be involved in this campaign, but what we did is we allowed them to measure their reputation. We said, here's a link, go and tell your friends about this problem that people face, this chronic hunger.
I mean, the reputation of participants.
Sure. That's an even different problem, and that gets to the heart of the sabotage, I think. And so that's, again, a place where you don't always have the luxury of knowing the reputation of people. Often the problems you'd like to solve mean that you're just taking the anonymous input of people. But I know that actually Ushahidi has done some work trying to look into how do you get reputation from sources. And there, it's quite interesting because a lot of their work has focused on Twitter. And on Twitter, you can somehow have a state of the system and understand history and these kinds of things. But it's not always possible to do that.
Time for one more.
Okay, so I'm interested in whether when you provide this incentive, like in the balloon problem, you get more responses if you have an invitation-only method where you give out a limited number of invitations and then people have to forward them, or you do that but you also provide a web URL where people can directly register themselves. And the question then is, does the
scarcity of the invitation somehow make it more valuable?
Well, more on the sender's side. The sender is motivated to send more invitations also, because otherwise people can just, you know, well, I'm not going to take your invitation, I'm going to go to the URL.
Right, so there's a couple interesting things. We actually wrote a paper about this that is coming out in Science soon, looking at this mechanism. And you can try all sorts of other mechanisms, and in many ways, there are problems in which taking a different approach, not going for the broadest possible exposure, but rather going for a more targeted approach, might be better. But at the end of the day, what you need your mechanism to do is to generate cascades. You need that whatever mechanism, for these types of problems, that whatever mechanism you come up with, that it has the capacity where it's in the interest of every person that's involved, like literally in the economic or other incented interest, to create a cascade so you can really drive these viral effects.
Thank you so much, Riley Crane.
Thanks.
For members of the